Welcome to Dose. In this episode, Eloise Sweetman, curator and co-founder of Shimmer in Rotterdam, and Isabel Sully, artist based in Rotterdam and assistant curator at Kunstverein Amsterdam, visit Transcorporealities at the Museum Ludwig in Cologne. Curated by Leonie Randinias as part of the Interdisciplinary Here and Now series, the exhibition brought together work by Jesse Darling, Flaka Haliti, Trajal Harrell, Paul Maeke, Nick Maus, Park MacArthur, Oscar Murillo, and Sondra Perry. It was a sunny, early winter day. After a long hiatus, we take up the final editing of this conversation in April 2020, at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic in Europe and the US, when each of us are on pause in our homes in Rotterdam and New York. What was a conversation about access and about materials, sounds, and thoughts seeping into the public realm now has acquired another, charged meaning. As we edit this conversation, most museums around the world are closed to the public, some tentatively making reopening plans that come with strict guidelines. Only a handful of people per gallery, only one person per 2.5 square meters. Guards are meant to remind visitors to follow marked itineraries through the gallery space and can ask people to keep moving, so restricting the time you can spend with a single work. And this is when people have actually made it into the space, after purchasing online tickets, receiving or bringing a face mask, and after the obligatory cleansing with hand sanitizer. At this moment, we have no idea how many spaces will be able or want to follow through on this and when they will do so. And inversely, we don't know which visitors will want to jump through those hoops. According to the curators, Here and Now specifically looked at the museum as a permeable body in which various biological, social, technological, political, and economic systems flow into each other. Like all human and non-human entities, it engages in perpetual metabolic processes with its environment. On that winter Sunday, Eloise and Isabel sat down on a lobby bleacher made by Colombian artist Oscar Murillo shortly before a 2 p.m. public performance, and contemplated the exhibition's aim. On this day, when the museum has been cut off from our physical environments and when exhibitions yearly stand on hold, some translated as bodiless virtual viewing rooms made for desktop or ambulating, and others semi-installed without any distributed documentation, we sit at our respective desks and add a third layer to some of the original thoughts had in Cologne. For this occasion, to try to create a moment of closeness and preserve a semblance of directness, Dose will not follow its original formula of redirecting authorial voices by introducing additional reader interpreters. This time, all of us speak in our own voices. Eloise interprets Eloise, Isabel interprets Isabel, and Sarah brings in a shared third editorial voice.
I'm feeling so self-conscious doing this recording here.
I know. But maybe this feeling goes hand in hand with the exhibition, which we thought was all about permeability and malleability, about the museum as an absorbent body, bringing things from the inside out. So maybe now you and I are doing what we should be doing as viewers and letting this exhibition spill over somewhere else where we feel it wouldn't otherwise.
I think we'll have a lot to say about permeability, as there is one element that I find extremely permeable in this context. One thing I noticed is that the ventilation system is so present, especially when it stops. People go quieter. It's a notable interruption. It feels like everyone is holding their collective breath. We all wait for the sound of the machine to start back up so we can also once more breathe.
This feels akin to the current pandemic and the impact on how we are in the world. We have become so conscious of the air we breathe and of the droplets of someone else's breath that might be in there. Air ventilation is now extremely necessary but also utterly suspect, as it may speed up the spread of contaminating agents. We're aware of that channel that breathes mechanically. It is too closely connected to our own body. Air is an immaterial bodily system we rely on, and it is trafficked through these nearly invisible systems of circulation.
Just to state the obvious, we're sitting on a tiered seating that's standing in the middle of a large lobby area. I can feel all the movement of the space on this structure. The museum is taking advantage of a place in the centre of Cologne that is a place of constant transit. We can even see the train station. We can even hear a busker play. This feels like a public square. The introduction cards to this exhibition state that every gallery is accessible. This is actually not the case of the Ludwig Museum. Visitors to this exhibition have to pay if they want to see the artworks on view in the actual museum galleries. Oh, someone just tripped over the low stage in front of us. People actually keep tripping over it. It's supposed to be invisible, but because of the tripping, it becomes more visible.
Yeah, that's so true. I actually thought it was a Park MacArthur work. It reminded me of a show she did last year at Essex Street in New York, where she borrowed access ramps from museums that she had previously shown work at and installed them as minimal sculpture. Murillo's stage seating is operating similarly. I can't tell if it's intended, though it does look like the recycled timber compared to the fresh timber of the structure we are sitting on. Which does make me think that the stage is the museum's doing, drawing an axis accidentally between both works. Also, just out of our line of sight, Jessie Darling's work across the foyer is apparently an attempt to devalue the preciousness of the artwork, to expose it to a point of access. But almost doing the exact opposite, inside the museum, Trajil Harrell has taken personal possessions and installed them in sanctioned museum display devices to raise them to the status of art. They both seem to draw the line of value along the question of access.
I don't think it's just about the object's place in space. It's also about the relation with one's body's space. Many of the works I can see from my vantage point also occupy a lot of space, but there is also not a lot of seating. Sondra Perry's works are objects with a seat, though. You're invited to sit, but in order to make room for others, you shouldn't sit too long, which is something I personally worry about a lot. I'm taking too long to sit with this artwork and someone's waiting for me to leave. And Jessie Darley's installation occupies many of the free lockers intended for the visitors' belongings. I'm really happy to see Park MacArthur's work, though. I haven't actually seen it in person, and I'm really, really happy about that.
Yeah, I feel the same. And the relation between her work and the stage we're sitting on is very successful. A juxtaposition between something that declares itself to be an artistic object and another one that doesn't. It's almost like these works are competing to find a balance between the functional and the aesthetic, or between being the centre of focus and the apparatus directing that very focus. In public space, or this public space, where is art happening? In thinking more about this show, I agree with what you were saying earlier. The exhibition occupies a transit space that is economised through how it's being inhabited.
Right. You're not meant to stop too long in a lobby. Museums become more and more the space where you're required to move relatively quickly in order to have other people come through. Perhaps this is why I'm so anxious about sitting on the only available seat if it's made available. That is why museums remove the seating. I think in the 19th century, Germany was one of the first countries to use seating in museums. From what I've read, back then, seating was created as a park, like you could have a picnic. There used to be a fire pit in the centre and you could stop. You could be lazy. You could be messy. As the idea of civility became more prominent, European museums became a place for a certain educated person who behaved in a particular way.
If those European museums or art galleries at their origin suggested contemplation, they were also seen as a place to spend time in, to pay close attention to the artifacts that embodies one's presumed culture. Post-COVID-19, or in reopening scenarios, visitors may hurry, either because of personal worry or because of a museum mandate to keep it moving. A gallery then comes close to a place of transit. We won't want to go closer to someone else. Previously, that may have been something to enjoy, to go see what another person is zooming in on. Forget blockbuster shows. Well, maybe this is not so bad, but forget also bumping into someone else because you are just so concentrated on seeing all sides of a sculpture and not paying attention to your surroundings. That makes it seem that the other visitor is now more like a circumspect outsider, not like someone who's in it with you. Such increased public consciousness definitely goes against the democratizing principle that most of contemporary art holds high.
What you're saying reminds me of a work by Sanya Vikovic that I saw recently. It's 10 large-scale pixelated photos, which she took in 10 different places across Europe and North America, of public park benches that have become privatized through different civic regulations. Like a coin slot that makes spikes retreat when filled with money, as one extreme example. This exhibition makes gestures against privatization, but in doing so also shows the limitation of the art object in being able to truly do that. For example, Nick Mouse has these three painted mirror panels in the modern art section of the museum. They moved the work inside the museum to protect the piece, I assume, but of course this is also a value decision. And when I say moved, I mean to say that with only two works inside the museum and a majority in the foyer, you can't help but feel as if the foyer came first, rather than the majority of artists coincidentally selecting the same external space for themselves.
That is true even with the textile works by Paul Maheke. They're actually quite robust and they can be handled or navigated, but they're also treated like they need protection. And the Park MacArthur and Jesse Darling's works are surrounded by a tape on the floor, which functions as a barrier. When you come too close, you're asked to step away. Which is interesting with Park MacArthur's work because it is from a polyurethane foam and the idea is that it should absorb sound, so you should be able to come closer. And in this large space, it should be much bigger to actually work.
I believe there are other ones of a similar size and shape that she has made, which she makes contact with at full speed in her wheelchair, experimenting with the shock-resistant material she uses to construct them. So yeah, I agree. It seems to be about approaching in a certain sense, and yet here a similar work is barricaded off. That said, I'm not sure about the politics of engagement with MacArthur's work once it has become sculpture. How does her activity correspond with the physical experience of the viewer?
It's interesting to note that we're being watched by a security guard. We should also acknowledge that people are doing a really good job here.
Yes, securitization is rife. And those MacArthur barriers, they also have a do not touch icon, which I find such a contradiction in its instruction because her work seems to be about robustness and mobility, about being handled almost. Yet here they are treated like pristine modernist sculptures, which is a particular curatorial decision, as in this very same context, the Oscar Murillo work welcomes you to sit on it.
Yeah, I feel so self-aware because I have schmutz on my shoes. It's also clearly art that I may be soiling. But with this Oscar Murillo work, we should also talk about the human-sized dolls, or effigies, as he calls them, on this seating structure. I'm also curious about the holes inside these dolls' bodies. At first I thought it was only the women, and then I realized it wasn't. I wonder what this is about.
The figures look as if they're in worker uniforms to me, like manual laborers. They have leather gloves and steel-capped boots and heavy cotton shirts. There seems to be an association with the local manual labour economy.
And this connects again to the origins of the museum. I was thinking about the Tailors Museum in Haarlem in the Netherlands. It was founded by a textiles manufacturer. His museum was for his factory workers and it featured the objects he collected from his travels. Art is a good way to educate. I believe that. But it also should not be limited to such class distinctions and not in a paternalistic way like a historical museum often does.
The Murillo work is so interesting because through the printed fabric of the seating cushions, he brings a work residing in the collection out of the collection space and into the free unticketed space of the lobby. It feels particularly pertinent as it's a work that has to do with the colonial relations of the history of the Ludwig collection itself. Hans Hacker's The Chocolate Master from 1981. Permeability is precisely about these bleeds. But I'm not so sure about this show. There are so many things that you have to do to make it work.
The reason why I like Charlotte Posanetska, whose work is not in this exhibition but whose practice I have studied extensively over the past years, is that she shows the boundaries that need to be pushed against. If everything was accessible, there wasn't anything to push against. That type of work integrates into architecture. The artist helps one navigate complex infrastructures.
This reminds me of Park MacArthur again. She says she doesn't make work about conditions, but in conditions, which is a similar position to Posanetska. It's more about being able to manage. You know, I like that Sondra Perry work more than I thought I would. It has forms that I recognise as being almost hip, but the videos take it further through talking about the objects that are integrated, which are exercise bike seats. It talked a lot about standardisation and optimisation, like Park MacArthur too, much more than I expected on first encountering it formally. You know, products and equipment still get tested all the time with the standard male dummy, one that is modelled after a Caucasian male slimmer body. This limitation makes other bodies less protected on industry-wide levels, particularly problematic in the health sector.
I was also struck by that work. There's the image and the element of vulnerability that I didn't expect. It tells you where it originated, it's located, and yet it is the voice of the machine.
The voice of Sondra Perry's sculptures personifies the machine. She addresses her work as having technological agency.
There is also a Paul Meckert connection here. He refers to the Uloi, a third gender alien species of the Onkale, from Octavia E. Butler's trilogy Lilith's Brood. In it, humans have to decide whether they will persist as a separate species or join the Onkale, who see humans as self-destructive because of their brutality to each other and to the Earth itself. The Onkale have octopus-like heads. And I don't think it's an accident that the Cosima von Bohnen works in this museum collection also have octopus shapes. As we are speaking about this exhibition, I begin to appreciate these connections more.
Also the connection between Nick Mouse's and Trajil Harrell's works. Harrell puts up his own possessions for sale after winning a prize. His other work is a wall-sized digital collage called 20 Looks or Paris is Burning at the Judson Church. It is about two parallel dance histories in New York, the experimental minimalist dance scene of Merce Cunningham and Yvonne Rainer, and the ballroom and voguing scene happening in parallel in a different part of the city. The work, which Harrell first actually formalised as a dance piece, imagines what a merger of these two concurrent dance histories would look like. But to me, this install is so dry, especially compared to the dance piece I coincidentally saw a few years ago. I mean, the 2D prints of the digital collage are still so much more lively to me than the vitrines holding his reconstituted possessions. But it seems that form of display is then related to Nick Mouse's printed mirror works.
To me, it seems those connections have a lot to do with how these artists' works are integrated into the museum space. Meckert's works are very integrated into the museum. Harrell's doesn't quite feel comfortable being here. The wall print creates an awkward, narrow passageway. MacArthur's block stands very close to the wall, so you are confronted by the small space that you go around it. I like that you are offered a different option of how you want to be confronted by the work.
Perhaps this narrow, slightly uncomfortable exhibition layout will be a thing from the past, like an old computer whose software can no longer be updated. A visitor's body now becomes a body with an added 1.5 meter radius. While museums might have been semi-conscious of how they dealt with body space when thinking about accessibility, the fact that from now on all bodies need more space will most certainly have an impact on how they exhibit art.
I think those are all very calculated decisions to give works little breathing space. Maybe it comments on what objects are given primacy in these kinds of spaces. For example, that corridor, it's about a body wide. The ability to stand back and get distance from the work is completely hindered comparatively to the possessions in the display cases that are generously spaced. I'm curious how physical proximity, forced or not, affects our engagement with works. There is this idea that we must give the work space and each other space, but what about attachment and extension, rhythm even, to naively borrow a dance term? For example, the lobby is important to me. It's a peripheral space, a framing device that makes the value of the centre possible. It's also architecturally attached and an extension at the same time. There's something with the out-of-placeness of the traditional museum vitrine and stool in Trajal Harrell's work that feels like a counter-value system. It has a distancing effect. Yet with the Jesse Darling locker works, it is as though they are being opened up. They are now being brought into civility. The private fantasy sphere is geared for public viewing. They look like a representation of a teenager's high school locker, in which you stick up these images of your celebrity crush or the secret notes you receive from friends in class, passed under the guise of a cough or a sneeze from a desk. Shrine-like, the work refers to Saint Ursula, who famously saved the remains of thousands of beheaded virgins in Cologne. The work seems to transfer the resoluteness of the gravestone to the magazine cutout shrine of the locker.
And just next to that, Flaka Haliti's blue sand is supposed to be tracked through the museum. It's a common gesture, but it can also be a really beautiful one. This translucent material has movement to it. It has an octopus-like kind of being. Sadly, it looks like the sand hasn't moved much.
Yeah, the show opened 2 months ago and the sand hasn't moved at all through the museum, unless it's been cleaned up. I think this speaks to the management of space. The borders of individual works are still pretty much contained. How could they be pushed more into a permeable realm while not totally giving up on individuality?
I don't know. It's really difficult. For example, with noise bleeding, it might affect the climate control system and there's also a level of sensitivity. Perhaps Meche's curtains could have been used in another way. The gesture of hanging the curtain in the line sight is very common. I can also see that the sand is aggressive towards the hole.
I think it's a paradox. I guess a very productive one that I don't think can be resolved. Maybe permeability comes back to the question of audience.
Yeah, that's actually the question right now. There is a silent performance going on. Three people are moving through the works in the lobby. I'm not sure if it's a rehearsal, but it's an interesting way of creating connection. Anything to do with a public program is a way of drawing connections. The public program allows for passing through with over to connect with works. People often approach programs as separate from the exhibition, but for me, the event is at the same level as the artwork. It is not something extra.
At the same time, I'm drawn to the idea of non-labour, of the museum as a site of rest. And now the removal of resting places, as we discussed earlier, makes it more like a site of transit. You go in and out in an orderly fashion, in the same ventilation cycle of movement. But again, at the same time, rest and education coexist. There's a social use of art as an educational tool. But because of this new class background, this comfortability in space has shifted. But we've been doing a lot of deconstruction, which is actually what I love about art. But on a personal level, I'm really curious. Do you like the show?
I really, really, really like the mouse room. It's a temporary gesture that totally works. But the overall idea of using the transitory space, I'm not so convinced after all. I'd rather see the exhibition dynamic move in and around and through the museum in another way.
Yeah, I can't help but feel that it's too simple to rely on the foyer or the passageway to determine the degree of permeability. Aside from that space being inside and outside at once, there isn't much done to reconstitute it. It still feels as if this is a pleasing gesture. Look, we're moving art out, allowing a more diverse group of artists in, but only temporarily and only at arm's distance.
There's also certain aspects of the museum that I feel just call for interventions. The small barriers, those niches on the floor, I don't know why those weren't used, for example.
It's a very odd guttering mechanism. I wonder what it's for.
I was thinking an artist could totally work with these spaces. Something more subtle as an intervention.
Do you think the transit element in this foyer brings a spectacular element to it too?
Yeah, I think they don't have time for the quieter gesture. They probably have to hit a number of thresholds. But as an interested audience member, I have the luxury of time and I can pay attention to those more subtle interventions.
Coming from Australia, as you do too, so perhaps we share this feeling, I am constantly surprised by the constitution of museum and gallery audiences in Europe. Culture permeates into the public sphere at a much more accelerated rate and in a much more accepted form. I am always very impressed by the audience makeups in these spheres. But I also look at how much artworks have to signal that they are an artwork in these public spaces. They always have to self-explain.
Yes, that's what's happening here again. But look, I think the performance is actually now starting.
And so Isabel's and Eloise's conversation made space for the performance by Nick Mouse. Some of the contradictions in here and now that they laid bare now feel from a then and there. But their question of what is and what isn't permeable has now become more real and is framed by a conversation about surveillance and constriction, about directing traffic. This episode of Dose was produced by Sarah DeMuse with Isabel Sully and Eloise Sweetman. Audio editing and content entry by Meredith Moran. Thanks for listening in and join us again next time.